I went into this traditional Goodyear welter tube shop, and it just felt like it hadn't changed for 100 years. There was no innovation. The staff just felt tired and there was no life to it at all. And I thought, they're so beautifully made, these shoes, but why not try a different sole? Why not try a different technique? You know, it kind of felt, God, that's been so done to death.
ShoeCast. Welcome to the Stitch Down ShoeCast, where we talk quality footwear, how it's made, and all the things we love about it. I'm Ben from StitchDown.com, and today I'm chatting with Tim Little, the owner and CEO of Grenson, the 157-year-old Northampton, England-based shoemaker that creates everything from classic British Balmoral boots, don't see a lot of those these days, to rubberized leather hiking shoes and everything in between. Most certainly, including their resounding triple welt brogues. I'm going to talk with Tim about how he got his start in shoe design with his own Tim Little Shoes line, how he started as creative director of Grenson in 05 before taking the whole damn thing over in 2010, how Grenson is kind of the same in some ways and also uniquely different from other Northamptonshire makers, and plenty, plenty more. But first, we need to give a special ShoeCast shout out to our sponsor this week, Grant Stone. Check out all their endless width options and their growing women's line at grantstoneshoes.com. Also, if you're the kind of person whose friends look at you weird when you keep talking about SPI count and the importance of proper quarter-facing gaps at parties, something tells me you'd fit in quite well in the Stitch Down Premium Discord, the finest place for the shoe and boot afflicted to all be afflicted together. We've got almost 1,500 people chatting day and night about established and emerging makers, leathers, last sizing, figuring out meetups, buying and selling with no fees in our marketplace, the whole thing. And if you're enjoying this podcast, the absolute best way to support it is with that very same Stitch Down Premium membership. More info on stitchdown.com on the Join the Discord tab. All right, it's time. Tim Little, owner and CEO of Grenson, welcome to the ShoeCast. How's everything? What are you wearing on your feet today, my man?
Hi there, how are you? It's good to talk to you. On my feet today, I'm wearing a pair of what we call Sneaker One, which is the first sneaker design that we ever did as a company. And we launched it about 8 years ago now. What we really do is we make a sneaker, but we make it out of the same kind of leathers that we make a Goodyear welter shoe out of. So I'm wearing a dark brown burnished Sneaker One with a dark brown cup sole.
Your sneakers look good, I have to say, even though I'm theoretically supposed to be opposed to sneakers, although I'm slipping on that recently. I was going to ask this one buried at the end, but I'm going to do it right now. Seems like every Goodyear welt brand needs to make a sneaker these days, and every is too far for sure, but plenty. And like that, you know, wasn't the case even 5 years ago, certainly 10. Why do you think that is?
You know, I can't think of many that don't actually nowadays in some way. Some do it as a collaboration and some do it themselves. We actually make sneakers in our factory in Northampton, as well as making overseas sneakers. But sneakers became such a part of the mainstream, and it went beyond what it was originally, which was a sports shoe, and became about 10 years ago, sneakers became dress shoes as well. So that kind of smart burnished leather that you would normally see in a Goodyear welter dress shoe was suddenly being worn by people as a sneaker, comfortable option. And basically, you know, the upper of the shoe is not that different from any other shoe, any Goodyear welter shoe or whatever. It's just a different sole on it. I think also that if you look back at Goodyear welted companies that are very traditional and have been for many years, if you look back into their real history and go back 100 or more years, they were always adapting to whatever the latest trend was anyway. They saw themselves not as traditional shoe companies back in, say, 1900. They saw themselves as shoemakers, and they made whatever shoes at the time were relevant and people wanted to wear. And I think that's important today. If you want to have a business that survives, I mean, for somebody like us, we never wanted to be a museum brand. We want to make relevant footwear that's based on the principles that have come from our heritage in terms of quality, and the way we do things. I'm just trying to think of a shoe company that doesn't really have some kind of sneaker somewhere in their offer.
Trickers. I don't think Crockett makes any sneakers, right?
Well, I think Crockett do, but Trickers have definitely made them in the past because they used to sell them in Italy. They don't make them in their factory, but they used to have a line of sneakers because I remember seeing them once a long time ago. So it's becoming part of the norm, I think, because that type of shoe is becoming important.
All right, I just found some Junior Watanabe Trickers full brogue multi-tone sneakers from a bit back, and yeah, they actually look pretty dope. So, all right, that's about the best answer you could possibly get. That said, when I was in London back in April, before we went to Northampton, went into the Lob store. Hey, you know, how's it going? We're going to bring a whole bunch of guys in here in a bit. What's going on in the shop? And he's like, oh, well, you know, we're just mostly selling sneakers. It's like, all right, that feels, it's good. You know, you're trying to sell shoes, obviously, but still felt a little weird to me.
Kind of for companies like Lob and Edward Green and the really, you know, kind of traditional companies, it does feel odd. But I think it's part of the way people have adapted and, you know, want to make sure they kind of feel as long as they do it in their way, it's possible and they can do it and they probably have to do it to stay kind of relevant. And I think we certainly did.
Do you see customers who maybe start out buying a sneaker, you know, first pair of Grensons, sliding over to welted product?
Not necessarily. I don't see it as an entry level kind of argument. It's not that kind of thing, I don't think. What we see a lot more is a guy who buys our chunky brogues might wear a triple welt, whatever. He also wants a pair of really comfortable, beautifully made sneakers as well. So it's more that, I think. And what we also find is sometimes younger guys who are just getting into, you know, spending a bit more money on shoes and are looking for something good, often actually come back to what we're originally known for, and they come in and buy their first pair of Goodyear welted shoes, if anything.
There we have it. So let's throw it back a little bit here to 1997, when you started Tim Little Shoes after jumping over, as I understand, from the advertising world.
Yeah.
Where'd you get a crazy idea like that, Tim? And what were the early days like?
God, it's so long ago, that is, isn't it? But basically, in advertising, the last 4 or 5 years of my life in advertising was running Adidas. I worked for an agency in London. We had the Adidas account. So I was flying around the world with Adidas. And I would sit in all these meetings where there was all this development and incredible materials they were working on, innovation, design, marketing, all kinds of stuff. And I loved it. It was really exciting. I remember coming back to London from a long trip and I wanted to buy a pair of smart Goodyear welted shoes. I went into this traditional Goodyear welted shoe shop and it just felt like it hadn't changed for 100 years. There was no innovation. There was nothing different. Everything in there I knew would be in there because I'd been in there kind of 2-3 years before. The staff just felt tired and, you know, there was no life to it at all. And I thought, they're so beautifully made, these shoes. But why do they have to just be the same shoe made every single... Who's designing them? Who's looking at what materials you could use? Why not try a different sole? Why not try a different technique? Why not try different stitching on the upper? Or why not make lasts that are a bit more quirky or a bit more interesting? You know, so keep all of that quality, all of that beautiful traditional way of making a shoe, but just make it a bit more interesting. That was the kind of idea. And the line that spun around in my head all the time was English shoes without the cobwebs. And it was, you know, instead of a picture of a guy with little glasses knocking nails into the sole of the shoe. And, you know, it kind of felt, God, that's been so done to death. Why not just take all of that quality? But a lot of the Englishness, keep the Englishness, the good bits, but not the bad bits. So throw away the kind of pompous bit. The flip side of that is there's the humor side. Whenever I'm in the States, you know, people talk about Monty Python and all that kind of stuff. So there's the quirkiness and the humor, which I like and is interesting. The pompous side, which I hate and don't like. So I thought, let's give it a go. I decided to start a brand which was traditional English shoes, but more interestingly designed and made out of interesting materials and what have you.
And who was making it?
The beauty of it was I could go to different factories who I thought were good at different things. So, for example, I had a Veltschen was made at Trickers. I had quite a lot of my shoes were made at Alfred Sargent. Then there was a company called White & Co., not to be confused by the American White company. And they had a small kind of production that I used to use their production as well. So, for example, a Veltschen. I hadn't seen a Veltschen anywhere. And as I started to research shoes and interesting shoes and what was going on, I started finding these kind of really quirky, interesting things like a Veltschen. And the whole story behind the Veltschen was fascinating. And so I think, well, that's perfect. That's relevant. And that's really cool. People want to know about something like that. It's made in a different way, where it came from, why. Why is it more waterproof than a normal welted shoe and so on. The traditional styling of the Veltschen, I thought, everybody's done that over the years. Let's just change it up a little bit. And I went to Trickers with a slightly different design, not hugely different, but you know, enough to make it look not like everybody else's. Another shoe, for example, was when I first came across a hole cut. It's interesting, actually, because talking to you now, I've suddenly realized I don't need to explain a lot of what I'm talking about because your listeners are very knowledgeable. So a hole cut, for example, made out of one piece of leather, difficult shoe to make, difficult pattern to create because it's quite difficult to find just that right shape that pulls over the last right because there are no seams to bend or anything. It was kind of finding these interesting stories about, so this was a traditional shoe from the past called a hole cut, and it was beautiful because it had no seams apart from a blind seam at the back. There was the Veltschen and what that meant. And there were lots of other things. And I loved these kind of shoe stories, the saddle shoe, the whole story of a saddle shoe, a correspondent shoe, which is also called a spectator, and why it's called a spectator in America and a correspondent in the UK. Shoemaking is rich in stories and history. And as an old marketing man, it was just a dream to be able to bring these things back and tell customers about them and tell potential followers of the brand and say, this is what this is, and this is why I've brought it back and why I've changed it a little bit as well.
What kind of design experience did you have going into starting a shoe brand?
Nothing. Zero. I'd sat in with shoe designers at Adidas. I'd sat in meetings for 5 years, like permanently, watching what went on, but I had absolutely zero design experience. I didn't really come at it from the angle that I needed to sit down with on CAD and design something to the nth degree. I knew what I liked and what I wanted. I started out in a very simple way, getting the last shape right. So I would do it by trial and error. So I would go to a last maker. Before Springline, there was a last maker called Mobbs Miller. They made my original lasts. When they went out of business, I've always used Springline since. That was a very good interview, by the way, with Michael from Springline, who I've known from the beginning.
I'm glad he finally got you the microphone.
Yes, exactly.
We love you, Michael. He's the best.
To answer your question, zero shoe design knowledge, but I would go to the factories and sit down with the guys, the pattern cutters, basically, who would design the patterns for the shoes and say, so normally you would make it like this, but I would like a last that's kind of slightly exaggerated, or it's got a curve on the last to give it a bit more character. Or I saw an old military shoe in a vintage shop, and I really like the way that last does that, but I don't like the back of it. And then they would make a last for me, and then I'd take it to the factory and get some leather pulled over it. And then I'd go back to the last maker and say, yeah, it doesn't quite work. Can you change this, change that? And the same with the actual shoes. So I think I had 8 styles to start with. You know, I was kind of doing it really logically, thinking, I need a Chelsea boot, I need a Derby, I need an Oxford. And then I'd get the lasts, and I started out with 3 different lasts. And then I went to the factory and I would brief in what I wanted and do very basic kind of line drawings. I think the biggest part of design for me often is knowing exactly what you want and knowing it when you see it. So something would come back and I'd say, no, that's not quite right. That's what a good designer is about. It's about that extra centimeter, millimeter, whatever it is, that eyelet is just slightly too small and it doesn't quite work on that boot because the boot's got a chunky sole and it needs to be beefed up a little bit. The other thing I did at the beginning, which was lucky, but I'll put it down as a masterstroke if you don't mind, and that is I found this guy who had been working in shoemaking his whole life, and he worked in a factory. He actually worked for George Cox, funny enough, and I met him about 6 months before he retired. Back in those days, when you got to 65, you had to retire. You weren't given a choice. You had to retire, and you don't anymore. He was about to retire, and he didn't want to retire. You know, he loved the shoe business, and he absolutely loved working, and he knew everything about making shoes. And so I said to him, look, I don't know anything about shoemaking, really. I'm a fanatic. I love shoes, and I read about them and stuff, but I don't really know anything properly about how a factory works or what have you. Can I hire you a day a week or something when you retire and you work with me? And so he was absolutely thrilled. So he went around with me for the first kind of couple of years of me starting my own business. And I realized that he was a real character as well. He had all these stories about shoemaking and all these kind of little anecdotes and things. And I thought, you know, customers would like that. So when I opened my shop in the King's Road in London, I said to him, look, do you mind coming down every Saturday morning? Because Saturday was obviously the busiest day. And he came down and he would be in the shop all day on a Saturday serving customers with, I had a shop manager, and then he was there as a kind of character in the shop talking to people about the shoes and what they were. And people just loved it because that's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to just say, here's a beautiful shoe and it's beautifully made. Yeah, great. I'll buy it. Thank you very much. Goodbye. I wanted people to know about what aniline leather was. I wanted them to know about why the eyelets were on this shoe are different from that shoe and what it means. And they lapped it up. They absolutely loved it. And to this day, we still have customers at Grenson that came over from Tim Little, who came to us in the very early days, and they kind of got into shoes and into the subject of shoes through that shop and through that guy. The only problem with him was I actually had to sit him down and say, listen, often these people are so exhausted after you've talked to them for an hour about how every stitch is made of this shoe that they're too tired to actually buy the shoe, and they walk out and say they'll come back another time. It's like at some point you've got to say, would you like to try it on? He was a legend. He was a real character, and that's what I love about the whole shoemaking thing, the kind of backstories and the info.
Man, so collectively with a small team and some willing factories, I mean, you guys made some fantastic stuff, like too much on the internet. There are some photos of Tim Little shoes out there, not nearly enough, but just glowing. I mean, from people writing blogs and... I mean, just Google Tim Little shoes and a bunch of Grenson stuff comes up and pictures of you.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Looking very debonair. But you can find the love that these people had for the footwear you were making. You made the announcement in 2021 that the Tim Little shop was closing, no more shoes. So what led to that?
Obviously, COVID was the biggest thing, but it wasn't just that. It wasn't because of COVID. When I started it, that was my living and my livelihood. And then I got involved with Grenson and eventually took over Grenson. And Grenson just became bigger and bigger and more involving every day, you know, and more difficult to have anything else that I had to focus on. So it was always more difficult to do the Tim Little thing properly. And I didn't want to ever do shoes that I didn't love, because the Tim Little side of it were my personal favorite shoes. It wasn't a business like Grenson where I think we need to do a shoe like that or we need a different Chelsea boot. If I wanted to do a quirky saddle shoe, let's say, I would just do it. I didn't care about a collection or about the seasons or anything like that. They were just a bunch of individual shoes in a shop. But also the big catalyst was when I first started, the way I hired, I wanted to have a shop manager would really look after customers and would really be part of the brand. I thought the only way to do this is I'm not going to go to a recruitment company. I'm going to walk around London to all my favorite shops, and I'm just going to go into shops and go shopping and go asking and talking to people. And if I find anybody who's like really, really good I'm going to ask them if they want a job. Probably not, you know, a great thing to admit to doing, but it was a very long time ago, so I don't mind now. But I came across this guy called Howard, and also he worked for a company that doesn't exist anymore, but it was on German Street. He was working in there, and I went into the shop, and he was absolutely brilliant. I was looking at a shirt on a rack, and he came over, and he was very light touch, you know, and he said, if you want any help, I'm just here. If no, no. And I said, well, actually, yeah, why is this shirt more expensive than this? And he said, well, it's all about the fabric. This fabric is more expensive. It's like a da-da-da. It's cut in this way. It's made in this factory and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I ended up hiring him. He started on day one. We opened the shop together on day one. And then when COVID hit, by this time he was in his 60s. He'd moved out of London and we were both talking about what next, you know, because I couldn't replace him. It was impossible. For me, he was part of the brand, and he was any customer of Tim Little who's been to the store will tell you about Howard, and they know Howard better than they know me, especially if they've come since I've been involved with Grenson and not there as often. Anyway, Howard was kind of ready to kind of move on or, you know, do whatever he wanted to do. And I just thought now's the time. COVID was difficult because everything had to be online and our real business was in the shop with people coming in face to face and spending time. And so I thought, this is the perfect time. I'm going to focus on Grenson. And then I thought, by the way, I can always like do collections because in the last 10 years or so, all the welter shoes were made at Grenson by this point. So I thought, well, I can always bring the shoes back. I could do some new ones, new designs. I could put them on the Grenson website if I wanted to. It just felt right. It felt like the right thing to do. And weirdly, it was profitable. We didn't close it because it was losing money or anything like that. It was very small business.
I mean, look, there comes a time, but hey, you still got a shoe brand. You started as creative director at Grenson in 2005 and ended up buying the whole damn company in 2010. I mean, how'd this all come about?
Well, the previous owner approached me and he'd seen the Tim Little thing. And this was in 2005 and Grenson was really struggling. It was pretty close to heading towards closing, I think. He saw what I was doing with Tim Little, which was like a kind of modern version of what they were about. And he approached me and said, would I come and get involved and turn the business around? You know, even when I was a kid, I bought Grenson shoes. And I thought, this is just an amazing challenge. What I'll do is I'll go and work there for about 3 months and maybe 6 months maximum. If it's too big a job, then I'll just say, look, it's not for me and I'm going to go back to my existing business and just crack on with that. And so after 6 months, it was like everything, the shoes, the production, the manufacturing, the distribution, they were in no stores, hardly anybody knew them. They didn't have a single store in London that they sold into. Most of the shoes were moccasins that were made in India. 60 plus was the average age buying them. So they didn't have a young audience at all. Everything was wrong. So I thought, this is too big a job. This is going to take years. It's probably not the right thing to do. So I did the obvious thing, which was to carry on and keep doing it. Because the thing by then was, you know, I'd fallen in love with it. Because you walk down into the factory and you talk to the guys. And the guys making the shoes are like always fascinating because they have amazing insights because they want to know about the future of the business because it's their future. Most people in the shoe industry in Northamptonshire, since the day they started, which in many cases would have been 16 years old, to the current day, all they've seen is factories closing down. All they've seen is the industry shrinking, and they've seen their friends, their brothers, their cousins, their parents losing their jobs because the industry's got smaller and smaller and smaller. So they're always looking over their shoulder thinking, what's happening here? And I'd go down into the factory and talk to them and they'd want to know what's happening, you know. And they'd say things like, the thing we don't understand is the shoes we're making here, when we go out on the street or we go to the pub and see our mates, we don't see anybody wearing shoes that look like this. It's a really, you know, really sensible, normal comment. It's like, yeah, it's not that difficult. You basically make shoes that people want to wear. Otherwise, you don't have a business. And the business wasn't doing that. And therefore, it was struggling. I fell in love with the people. I fell in love with the factory. And I fell in love with the brand. And so I just kept going. And come 2010, the guy who had hired me and asked me to do it was kind of ready to move on, and he had other business interests and he wanted to move on. So he asked me to sell the business, and cut long story short, I ended up buying it off him, which I make that sound quite easy. It wasn't that easy, but we got there in the end.
So obviously quite a bit changed. You took, in some ways, this very straightforward century and a half old Northamptonshire maker and turned it on its head a little bit. What was it like slapping that first white wedge sole on a Grenson brogue boot? Was there commotion? I feel like a lot of this stuff hadn't even been considered.
To give you a bit of context, unless you go back to kind of the 30s, 1930s or 40s, when Grenson was making just one type of shoe, Grenson wasn't really a company like an Edward Green or a Crockett and Jones that was very specific. It was a business that had always followed trends. It had always been quite experimental with the footwear. So I've got catalogs from the 60s and 70s with shoes with big chunky heels and almost like semi-platform shoes, very, very fashion-driven kind of styles. So although we were a traditional shoemaker in the sense that we made Goodyear welted shoes, a lot of the design and a lot of the way they looked would change quite radically over the years. And even if you go back to before 1900, I've got one pair of shoes that was made around 1900, an old pair of Grensons. And you go right back then, you can see that the shoe that I have would have been a very dandy shoe, would have been a very fashionable shoe. It wouldn't have been regarded as an old traditional shoe at the time. So I think the Grenson people who have worked there were quite used to a lot of different things coming through the factory. It wasn't a big deal, really. There were one or two, I think, that would say, oh, I don't understand that. You know, why are you doing something like that? But not really. They see themselves as shoemakers. They don't see themselves as designers. There's a lot of them in the factory as well who actually love it because it makes their life more interesting. They really love a challenge. They're very adaptable. And you ask them to do something they haven't done before, and it makes it more interesting for them. You know, they love the idea of it.
Factory-wise, as I understand, a portion of the Grenson line is made in India and a portion is made 100% in Northampton?
Yes, absolutely. When I first got to Grenson, about 80-85% of all the shoes that they sold were made in India. They'd got into making this thing that was a moccasin. But back in the kind of 60s and 70s, when they started doing that, they did what a lot of people do around the world, really, which is they bend the rules slightly. So a car, for example, if you buy an English made car in the UK, the engine might have been made in Spain, the chassis might have been made in Italy, the wheels might have been made in China, and it's assembled in the UK. And so if it's assembled in the UK, they can say it's made in England. Now, the footwear industry is famous for using that. Made in England, the basic kind of rules, if you like, are if the sole is attached, that's in shoemaking, that's called, or certainly in welted shoemaking, the making of the shoe is when the sole goes onto the upper. I wanted to say, if the shoe says made in England, it's made in England in our factory. The leather comes in the door. The eyelets come in the door, the laces, the thread, everything comes in the door. It's made into a shoe and it leaves with a Made in England badge on it, and it's fully made in England. But I also saw the reason why people made a lot of the uppers and various elements of the shoe overseas and brought them in was to bring in a lower price point. And one of the key things for me, because Grenson had a big history in making shoes overseas, and I thought, well, I'm not changing anything by doing that. They're just making the wrong shoes for me. And what I want to do is I want the brand to be accessible to a younger audience. And if you make a shoe just in the UK, it's expensive. And that younger audience can't afford that shoe. So your audience automatically becomes 60 plus. I wanted a 25, 30-year-old to say, I love those shoes. I love that brand. I want to wear a pair. You know, I did a lot of work in India because India had a tradition of working with English shoemakers from years and years and years ago. It had an enormous high quality industry of stitching and making uppers and what have you. That had a more recent history, but still a good history of actually making Goodyear welted shoes. And as with anywhere, any country, including this country, there's incredibly high quality manufacturers and incredibly low quality manufacturers and everything in between. And I found the best shoemakers in India, Goodyear Welted Shoemakers, and they make the most beautiful shoes. The shoes that we have made in India, we design in the UK, we CAD them up, we buy the leathers ourselves. We use exactly the same leathers that we use on our welted footwear or our UK footwear, whatever you want to call it. And we go to Italian tanneries and Portuguese and French, and you know, and we the shoes are absolutely beautiful, and they come back into the factory, we check the quality, and they're amazing. The country where something's made has a kind of a relevance to it in a way. And I'm saying that as an owner of an English factory. And let me tell you, running a factory is a very hard thing to do and takes up most of my time. So I'm very, very proud of what we do.
So to be clear, I'm all for manufacturing in England, in Northampton. Very supportive of it for a whole bunch of confusing reasons that people recently have been yelling at me about on YouTube in the comments. You have a good thing going on in India. Hit a better price point. You seem to be very happy with the quality. Why make anything in Northampton?
It's the heart and soul of the company. We can only get a shoe made outside of our factory, wherever that might be, if we have the knowledge and understanding of shoemaking and it comes from our heart. So when we make a shoe somewhere else, we do it with an incredible knowledge because we know exactly how to make a shoe properly. And nobody can pull the wool over our eyes with a shoe and say, well, this is that, and you know, we've done this way because it works better. We know better than anybody how that shoe should be made, and it's made exactly to our specifications. And it's the heart and soul of the company, and long may it continue. I think it's absolutely crucial. I think if we didn't make in the UK, if we didn't make in our own factory, we would ultimately be less knowledgeable and we would lose the craft and understanding of the craft that is important and is within all of our shoes, wherever they're made.
Love that answer. Let's dwell on that for a second while we take a break. Be right back. Tim Little from Grenson. Okay, so here's my really quick personal Grantstone sizing story. Grantstone has as impressive a sizing and width range as any ready-to-wear, ready-to-ship footwear brand. Their whole promise is to ensure you're covered. Here's how I'm covered. First pair, size 10.5D Ottawa boots, Leo Last. Loved them. Instep was too tight. Heartbroken. Suede chukkas, also on Leo Last, notch up to 10.5E, perhaps my best fitting overall pair. Getting somewhere. 10 triple E diesels on a wedge sole represent Leo Last. I wear them with huge socks, and they're a blast. Plenty of width, not too short. 10.5E brass boots, perfect, love them. 11E chestnut calf traveler penny loafers, and step was too tight. I can wear them for a bit, not all day. Semi-heartbreak. 11E traveler penny loafers in suede, which fit big and beautifully. No instep pressure at all because the suede is just so much more forgiving. Wyatt said to me as we were discussing my sizing, and I'll never forget this, go big man, just jump right in them. He was right. They're fabulous. So what's your point, Ben? Well, through a combination of lasts, lengths, widths, patterns, and leathers, which, when you permutate them all together, numbers into the many, many thousands, Grantstone can fit a huge percentage of feet on this planet and fit them very, very well. That's a beautiful thing. Check out their whole lineup and start up a sizing conversation with the Grantstone folks at GrantstoneShoes.com. And now, back to the ShoeCast. All right, we're back with Tim Little of Grenson on the ShoeCast. Just great breakdown of, you know, your path and Grenson's history. I'm loving it. Obviously, as you said, it's tough to run a shoe business if people don't want to buy your shoes. And it seems like that's definitely the case. At this point in 2023, who is that Grenson customer, and has that changed since you started?
What I'd like to think is that most of the customers that we had before haven't necessarily left. We haven't alienated people, but what we've done is bring in new people. And I think the biggest single difference is that we brought in younger people. The average age of the Grenson customer is now a lot younger. I'm really proud of that because, you know, that's a hard thing to do in a business. It's easy to find older customers. It's much more difficult to persuade a younger person, especially on a high quality thing because they have less disposable income. This is a really boring answer, I know, because kind of everybody says it a bit, but people say, you know, what's your typical customer? We get guys who are like 80 years old who are sending their shoes in and saying, can I get a repair on this or, you know, whatever. And then we're getting 25-year-olds who are coming into our shop in Shoreditch and saying, when's the sale? But I want that pair of shoes in the window, but I can't afford them. You know, it's more of an attitude in a way than an age or a demographic or whatever. The way I categorize it is, it's obviously quality is the most important thing or the first thing in their mind. It's a timeless product. Although we do shoes that are probably a little less traditional than some of the Northampton companies, you know, there's nothing in our collection that's completely mad. It's like they're still fairly simple, the shoes that we design and the shoes that we make. They might have little twists or quirky or a slightly different shape. Almost everything in every shoe you see on our website comes from our DNA.
Have you found that those customers, you know, while there is this DNA flowing through everything, especially compared to some of the more traditional British shoemakers, Brinson can be a bit more fashion forward, at least at times. Have you found that that audience, both younger and fashionier, cares about some of the more technical aspects or the quality aspects, lasts and construction and materials? Are you getting them up to speed, even though they didn't realize what they were getting into? Like, what's all that look like?
There's a certain section of our customers, probably some of who are listening to this now, who absolutely revel in the detail and they absolutely love how the things are made. They know all the styles. They know the styles better than me. But then I think the majority are not like that. They don't just buy the shoe because they look at it and go, oh, I quite like that. I'll have a pair of those. There aren't so many of those, but they buy it because they know it's good quality. And they trust the name. They trust our heritage. They just want to know that it's going to last them. And if they spend £300 on a shoe or £500 on a shoe, that shoe is going to look after them.
All right, let's talk about some shoe head stuff. Your triple welt, which I don't believe was historically part of the brand. I could be wrong there. How'd that come about? Let's just talk about it because they're arresting.
Is that a good word, arresting?
That's a good word over here, yeah. Nobody's going to. I mean, you could potentially get arrested while wearing them, but probably not for the shoes. They grab you, right? You're like, whoa, this one kind of the same, but clearly something's going on here.
When I kind of started in shoemaking, there was a bit of a thing about how designer Italian shoes that were really slim soles and very delicate, it was all about that. And I noticed like quite a few English shoemakers were trying to make thinner and thinner soles and trying to make them look almost Italian, with quite pointy last shapes and what have you. But what I thought was, well, what we're about is not that. A good English Goodyear welted shoe is about being chunky and it's about being fit for purpose. And it's about being in a way, not rustic's probably the wrong word, but solid and dependable. It's not about looking really finessed and, you know, kind of really slim and what have you. So I wanted to make a shoe that was really celebrated the Goodyear welting process. A shoe that you could look at and go, oh, okay, I get it. Not a shoe where the sole was hidden behind making it thin and darkening it down so you almost didn't see it to make it more elegant, but the opposite. Let's make the most of that welt. Let's make the most of that sole because that's why this shoe is different from other shoes around the world. And so I was in the factory one day, the sole stitcher, a wonderful guy, came up to me and said, oh, I'm messing around with this kind of technique the other day. I just wondered what you thought of it, you know, and he showed me this shoe that he'd made. He showed me this triple welt. He had done it from start to finish. And the way you see the triple welt now is exactly what he showed me on that day. Because normally I'll change something. I'll say, oh, I really like that, but let's just change that or change this. He showed me this thing and it's exactly the same today. And I loved it, absolutely loved it, because you look at it and you go, that is the welt, that is the shoemaking. All of that stuff that goes into a Goodyear welted shoe that you can't see, suddenly there was this little visual symbol, if you like, of showing that shoe. You look at that shoe, you know that's a lot of craftsmanship in that shoe. The triple welt is all out there. This is a proper Northampton Goodyear weltered English shoe, and it's in your face, and I love it for that. I absolutely love it. And I knew that when you make something a bit mad like that, there are many, many people who will never buy it, but that's not a reason not to do it, because the people who do buy it absolutely love it, and it becomes a kind of mini cultish thing.
I've handled a pair, but I've never tried them on before. Is it like some work, or, you know, do you do some tricks of the trade with materials, et cetera, to create a wearable shoe?
It's a commitment to wear it. It's a commitment. So all of those things about a Goodyear welted shoe, which is the more you wear them, the better they get. And if you flip that around, that means that they're not the most comfortable shoe in the world when you first put them on sometimes. Sometimes they can be, but many times, you know, people will say, oh, they're quite stiff and they take a bit of breaking in. But they get better and better and better the more you wear them, as opposed to the opposite. The triple welt is everything about a welted shoe. It's exaggerated. Even when you first put them on, you think, wow, I don't think I'm going to go on a 30-mile hike in these on the first day that I wear them.
Your Veltschuhen shoes are, I mean, that's actually the construction you're using.
We have two or three styles that we make as Veltschuhens, yeah, and it's very rare these days. And as I said before, I came across it when I first started and found it an interesting kind of shoe and a story. So I wanted to make it at Grenson. They'd made it at Grenson years before, but hadn't been making it for a long time. It's quite expensive to make, and it's really takes specific skills that a lot of factories don't have. It's just a really beautiful, proper, again, you know, it's proper old traditional English shoemaking.
Definitely in terms of the construction is obviously intriguing, but I mean, just as a shoe, I mean, those are, you know, perhaps my favorites in the entire line. I think it's cool and pretty slept on. You don't really hear too many people talking about them. So maybe we change that.
Yeah, I think so. And there aren't many people who make them. So that's why you don't hear many people talking about them. But for anybody listening to this, go to the website or just, you know, type in Veltschuhen into the spelling's a bit tricky. Don't ask me to spell it, but go and have a look at what they're about and go and have a look at some of the diagrams of how they're made, because that's quite interesting. You know, basically, at the end of the day, the most simple way of describing it is that the upper comes down and forms the top of the welt. So there's no gap between the welt and the upper for water to get in. It's a continuous piece of leather.
All right. So we have a long history on this podcast of nobody knowing how to pronounce anything correctly or there being great disagreement. But spelling, let's see, V-E-L-D-T-S-C-H-O-E-N.
Correct.
Got it?
Yeah, are you sure you're not? I think you were reading that.
I was not. Even in my notes, I just abbreviated it.
Google's a wonderful thing, isn't it?
That was legit. You've mentioned the women's line, which has expanded under your watch, you know, and with Goodyear welted product too, I believe. How is designing women's shoes different from designing men's shoes?
We started out, and we still really mostly make men's shoes for women. So we started out very much just doing women's versions. So they're on a slimmer last. I wanted to keep exactly the same toe shapes, but make them fit better. So normally the back of the last is narrower in particular. And I love the idea of the men's shoes for women. And it really started because people were asking us for them. You know, women were saying they loved their partner shoes. And why didn't we make them for women? In that sense, it was quite easy. I think as time's gone on, we've started to design more shoes that are specifically for women and move it on a little bit. So we do a few things that, and that's more challenging, I think, just because I didn't grow up doing that. You know, I grew up doing men's shoes and I know about that. And I feel to a certain extent as well, you know, how everybody says they started their brand just so that they could design clothes or shoes that they would buy themselves. You know, well, I'm still doing that today. You know, if I don't like a shoe that we've designed, it doesn't go in the range. Even if I think it might sell well, if I don't like it, it's not going in the collection. With women's, it's more difficult because I can't say I would wear that shoe or I wouldn't wear that shoe. What I never wanted to do was take a really lovely shoe, like I say, a triple welt, for example, as we've just talked about that, and feminize it in an old sense of making it not quite as chunky. And I really like the idea of doing exactly that, but make it fit better for women.
you made some boots with our friend Jack Millington, the chap who started Billy Tannery on his parents' goat farm. We have a ShoeCast episode from maybe a year and a half ago with Jack. What did you think of that goat skin that you used for those boots? Because I have a bunch. He was carrying a pair when I saw him in London, but I never worn a pair, and he hadn't worn them at that point too. He was too afraid.
It's really nice. It's very natural. It's very good for shoemaking. It pulls over the last really well. He came to me years ago, and when he was kind of just starting out, and I said, well, look, when you've got it to the level and you want to make some shoes, you know, we'll do it. We'll make something in the factory. Because I love the story. I love people starting out and entrepreneurs, and, you know, I know how hard it is to start a business. You know, somebody like him doing something that nobody else is doing, you know, all the tanneries are pretty much closed down in the UK. I think he said to me the other day, he's the first new tannery in the UK for 100 years. And you think, wow, you know, that's amazing. Loved working with him. The leather was really interesting, really nice, very natural. You can see the grain in it. And we chose to keep it as natural as possible. We quite like, with projects like that, leaving growth in and, you know, having a bit of the actual natural, real markings in the leather actually in the shoe and not leaving it on the floor of the factory.
You offer customized footwear to Brenson Lab. What's that look like? And then do you offer full bespoke at this point as well?
We do both. So we do full bespoke. We do all the measuring. The last are made at Springline. Then we make up the shoes in the factory. Most of that is done via appointments in our stores in London. We've always had this Grenson Lab thing, which is, I think most Northampton makers do it, which is, it's like a special order, really. So if there's a shoe that you like in the collection, but you'd like your version, could I have that in this, in a different color, on a different sole? Then we make it up as an individual pair. And I think the cost is something like 30% or something more than a stock shoe. I always thought that people would go for something really mad and really, you know, kind of design the shoe themselves, but they don't tend to. It tends to be people who just want something in a different color that you don't do. It's incredibly disruptive for the factory, as you can imagine. So they love it, obviously. I think it's a nice service to do. And as a shoemaker, I like the idea of offering full bespoke. Our bespoke is factory bespoke, you know, so it's not hand-lasted bespoke. And it's not what they call, you know, full bespoke, really. At Tim Little, I used to do full bespoke, which was proper, completely handmade, hand-stitched, hand-lasted, the whole soup to nuts. This is made in the factory. But, you know, we make your last and then we make the shoe up in the factory. And we cut the pattern to fit the last, to fit your foot. It goes around a factory instead of going to a little workshop at the back of somebody's house in Northampton.
All right. So, I mean, we've covered a lot. I think this gives a pretty good look at the last 20 years of Grenson and, you know, where it was before that and where you've taken it. What's Grenson look like in another 20 years?
I haven't got a clue. I think in 20 years, I won't be here. So it will be down to somebody else. Hopefully you'll be interviewing them. I think more has changed in footwear and menswear generally in the last 10 years than changed in 60 years before that, in a way. The whole dressing down culture has completely like taken over now. So for a while, it used to be dress down Fridays. I don't know if anybody remembers those, but when the dot-com boom around 2000 happened and a lot of companies in the city would allow you to wear jeans on a Friday or chinos or something, not jeans, oh, but chinos and that.
Or chinos.
Yeah, mad. You know, it was like crazy. It was like rebellion. Men see, for example, sneakers. Sneakers can be really smart dress shoes that people wear and get married. And they'll get married in a bespoke suit and a pair of dark brown leather sneakers with a brown cup sole, you know, and that is a normal thing nowadays, you know, for a lot of people. So in technology, it's changed even more. So there's this whole thing about the molded shoe, you know, whether it's Balenciaga or originally Crocs, but then everybody's got a molded shoe. And you think that's a completely different industry from what we're about. It still does the same job in a different way, in that it protects your foot and you can walk along the street in it. But apart from that, it is completely another world. And you think somebody of my age and experience, kind of for many, many years, nothing really changed a huge amount. And by doing the things that I've done, was often thought of as a bit of a maverick, you know, kind of 20 years ago. But the things that are happening now are moving on so much further and faster than back then. So I have no idea what will happen in the future. And I know that whatever it is, Gretchen will have to adapt and will have to be part of the change. I don't think there's an enormous future for companies that just become, as I say, a museum brand. Ultimately, I think they get smaller or there ends up only being one of them because you don't need lots of them. And I think a lot of Northamptonshire companies went down because of that, because they weren't relevant. So the future is about being relevant, but always holding on to our principles and never forgetting our heritage.
Man. All right. We got to call it somewhere. That seems like the perfect place. Huge thanks to Grant Stone for sponsoring this episode. And thank you for listening. Support the ShoeCast and your visionary, maybe crippling, but visionary footwear habit by joining the Stitch Down Discord. More info at stitchdown.com. Most of all, huge thanks to you, Tim Little. Love this, man.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
All right. That's it for this week. Take care of your shoes. We'll see you next time.